It's showtime.
Okay, Tokyo, South America, Australia, France, Germany, UK, Africa.
Here we go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. Here we go, off and running for this thorn in the side Thursday. It is the 6th day of May, 2021. This is The Horn. HeadOn.live is where you'll find us on the interweb tubes. That, of course, is also where you go if you'd like to be part of the merry, madcap, wacky, zany, real-time multimedia extravaganza that is The Horn chat room in the 3 hours in which this program is live, Monday through Friday, 5 to 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, 2 to 5 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. And if you pop over there right now, you will be greeted by early arrivers, Squeaky and Stockton Larry, and capably moderated by longtime inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator, Sparky, who, although he is a third stage guild navigator, has declined to fold space and become man cave. He is capably assisted, of course, by his trusty, longtime pinch hit midweek chat room utility moderator and all around great guy, Brother Bishop Steve from Georgistan. Yes. And so more folks will be wandering in. Maybe you'll be one of them. Hi, I'm Robin, and let me first of all apologize for my absence last night. Sometimes these things are unavoidable, and yesterday was one of those unavoidable things. We should be streaming. And Brother Deacon Asa tells me 999. Yes. Billable Rick, are you live today? Methinks you are. The banner on HeadOn.live states that Robin will not be live today. Robin is live today. That just hasn't been... maybe that just hasn't correct been updated yet. No, I am Rat Cheer. I'm Rat Cheer. R-A-T-C-H-E-E-R. Rat Cheer. That is an example of spoken Appalachian, yes. And so every program here at The Horn begins with gratitude, and this program is no different. And so thanks go out at the beginning of this and every program for the wonderful community of people who keep this program going. And so that being the case, thanks go out to John. Thank you, John. Thank you to Michael in Madison. Thank you to Don in West Tennessee. Thank you to Kim and Malin in New Jersey. Thank you to Kitty in Boston. Thank you to Charlene in Rogues Island. Thank you, Bob. Thank you very kindly. Let's see here. To Lauren in Far Canoodlia. Thank you to Kevin in Colorado Springs. Thank you, Kenda in Missouri. Thank you, Bernice, Betty Boop. Thank you, James in Illinois. Thank you, Roberto. Thank you, oh so kindly, to our pal Jessica with the Bullseye Challenge. And I will share that with you in a moment. And thank you very kindly to Barbara for jumping in. And helping out yesterday and into today, what that means is that the fundraising goal right now for the program is at $870. $870 to come up with, to reach this day in how we try to manage to keep things on the air. So thank you again, one and all, to those who keep things going, keep the plates spinning on all the sticks. Thank you, Jessica. Jessica said the $10 bullseye challenge is on the table, so I wanted to participate in Friday's shenanigans because it was too exhausted after a long work week, but I thought the Horn family would find this amusing. And since yesterday was Star Wars Day, that was 2 days ago, and today is Revenge of the Fifth, that was yesterday, and Joey's been talking about Canadian geese in his journal the past few days. It's apropos. On the 17th of November last year, I was in Rochester. That's the Greater Rochester Co-Prosperity Sphere in Minnesota. For appointments at the Mayo Clinic and stopped by Target, also a wonderful Minnesota-based company, for a few provisions. As I was returning to my Fiat, or Jeep, yeah, see what you did there, a formation of Canadian geese flew overhead until the last few years as the power plant has been slowly taken offline. Silver Lake has been a warm winter refuge for an inordinate number of mallard ducks and geese. As most of the other individuals living within the Greater Rochester Metropolitan Co-Prosperity Sphere, I have frequently experienced flyovers without incident until Tuesday, November 17th, 2020. As the formation flew over me, something impacted against my back. Shit! Literally. I was wearing my good leather jacket and expected to find a smear against my back. No, it was clean. I thought a second and knew there had to be material somewhere. Then it occurred to me, I hesitantly reached inside the hood of my sweatshirt. Yep. My right hand touched damp pellets. I was less than happy about the situation, by the way, taking an early run at dinner in the Eastern Daylight Time Zone, but at the same time I was impressed by the fact that a Canadian honker had been able to bullseye my hoodie from roughly 300 to 500 feet. Not unlike a certain moisture farmer from Tatooine bullseyed a 2-meter exhaust port on the Death Star. So hence the $10 bullseye challenge to fire a few proton torpedoes down the exhaust port of the current outstanding debt of the evening. And so the bullseye challenge is on the table. Oh, my God. That sounds like something that would only happen to me. But no, it happened to Jessica. Well, sorry. So the bullseye challenge is on the table. And this from Joey and Giraffe. Robin! The doctor makes house calls, part one. You were talking about Carl Hubble, baseball's Hall of Fame pitcher who was the master of the screwball and is a very young Joey. I actually read a book about the great Carl Hubble and his screwball. As it turns out, few pitchers threw the screwball because it was a difficult pitch to master and hard on the arm. Another Hall of Fame pitcher, Christy Mathewson, who pitched for the New York Giants from about 1900 to 1920, was the inventor of the screwball, and a very young Carl Hubble, while working his way up through the New York Giants farm system, contacted Christy, and Mathewson gave advice to Hubble as to how to throw said screwball. Jeffrey, with a sad note, unfortunately, in real life, the great Christy Mathewson got screwed out of a long life because while serving in the Army during World War I, Mathewson was exposed to chemical weapons during training, rendering his respiratory system weakened from the exposure, causing him to contract tuberculosis, from which he died in 1925. Mathewson ended up being the third winningest pitcher of all time, with 373 wins behind Cy Young and Walter Johnson. He won all those games without ever pitching on a Sunday, as the old song goes, never on a Sunday. No, Christy Mathewson never pitched on Sunday because of his religious beliefs, but did pitch on many prayer meeting Wednesdays. Now, this was from yesterday, and Joey noted, damn it, Jeffrey, it's Cinco de Mayo. This is supposed to be a happy day and a day to celebrate. Why'd you have to bring it down with that story? Jeffrey, you and I are going to have to get our second Pfizer shot, and ironically, Billable Rick in Los Angeles is also going for his second shot as well. Many of you may remember Rick and I also received our first shot back in April on the same day. So Jeffrey and I are going to celebrate Cinco de Mayo after our second shot and head to Jalapenos. Fuck the Gatorade. We're having Long Island iced teas to celebrate this momentous occasion. Yes. My mother and I often discuss the inequities of baseball and how different players benefited from playing in more hitter-friendly parks than others. In this case, baseball really mirrors life, considering all the baseball stadiums are different and some are much easier to hit in and hit home runs within the different contours of the confines. So many baseball historians believe that Babe Ruth is really the king of home runs because he excelled amazingly in the dead ball era, where home runs were hard to come by. Meanwhile, Hank Aaron probably played in the easiest ballpark ever to hit home runs, Atlanta's Fulton County Stadium, as in the hot summers, the baseball just carried effortlessly out of the park. Along the same lines as Ruth, how many home runs did the great Willie Mays lose playing in probably the worst park of its time for hitting home runs, namely the Stick, Candlestick Park in San Francisco? And Jeffrey has an estimate. I, Jeffrey the Giraffe, estimate Willie may have lost as many as 100 home runs over the course of his career, playing first in the Polo Grounds with that deep center field and then in Candlestick, where the nighttime winds from the bay would whip and swirl so badly the baseball just would not carry very effectively. Mays ended up with 660 home runs. It's his birthday, by the way. And if you had 100 more home runs, which broken down was about 5 home runs a season, a very conservative estimate, Mays would have ended up with 760 home runs, and that would have been more than Barry Bonds. And we won't even discuss Barry Bonds' steroid. Yeah, good job. Good job, Jeffrey. I think you covered all the bases, but forgot to wish Willie Mays a happy 90th birthday. Happy birthday to the Say Hey Kid. And speaking of Hank Aaron, may he rest in peace as he just passed in January. However, on April 8, 1974, Hank Aaron hit number 715 and officially passed the Babe. The Atlanta Braves wanted to keep the ball that Aaron hit in-house so the organization could preserve it, so as Aaron's home run sailed over the left field fence in Atlanta, an Atlanta pitcher by the name of Tom House caught the ball, and the Atlanta organization had successfully kept Aaron's momentous home run number 715 in-house. I remember seeing Tom House running out of the left field bullpen racing towards home plate after he caught Aaron's 715. Tom House could have been a male model with his striking good looks and beautiful curly blonde hair. So with a big smile and full of exuberance, Tom House presented Henry Aaron with the ball. His huge smile and all that curly hair just really stuck in my mind. I received both Sport Magazine and Sports Illustrated back in the 70s, thanks to my mother, not long after Aaron's home run. One of those publications ran an article on Tom House, with the gist being how amazing it was for a guy such as House, who probably should not even be on a major league roster, considering his lack of talent, actually caught Aaron's baseball and is now famous. The article went on to explain that House was basically a junk ball pitcher who utilized brains and courage because he had no fastball to speak of, but simply persevered and survived with a curveball and a screwball. I always wanted to be a baseball pitcher when I was young Joey, and I was very curious about just how Tom House threw that screwball, because House was obviously good enough to get to the major leagues and compete at that level, so he must have had some talent. As I read the article about Tom House back in the early summer of 74, I thought to myself, I'd love to meet the man who caught Henry Aaron's 715th home run ball and ask him about how he throws that screwball. As it turns out, that little dream would come true, and that'll be part two of this Doctor Makes House Calls tomorrow. So stay tuned on the same bat time and the same bat channel. This has been Joey's Journal for Prayer Meeting Wednesday, Cinco de Mayo, 5th of May, 2021, and now the 6th of May, 2021, with Giraffe wearing his Mexican sombrero and waiting for his numero uno shot. Thank you, Joey. Thank you, Giraffe. And so, in addition to the Bullseye Challenge, there's a $20 Fuck the Gatorade Challenge on the table. Thank you for that, Joey and Giraffe. Fuck the Gatorade. We're having Long Island iced tea. Yeah, going to a Mexican restaurant for Long Island iced teas. Gotta love it. Gotta love it. Ralphs has met the Bullseye Challenge. Thank you, Ralphs. So that leaves the Fuck the Gatorade Challenge on the table. And Dave number 11 adds, the screwball was the only pitch I could throw with any movement. The fact that the movement was to the sweet part of the bat didn't seem to please any of my teammates. Yeah, that's quality, Dave. Moved right over the plate, right in the wheelhouse. Every time. Yeah, yeah. So that kind of gets us started. And when last we spoke, somewhat shortly after the close of the program on Tuesday, I just posted, there was no link or anything, I posted an observation on Facebook that, my God, every time, and it gets, you know, it's all, it always seems to be this way with maggots and whatnot, but every time you think that they've found the absolute bottom of awfulness, they and open up a trapdoor into the sub-basement of stupidity. And that certainly applies to Caitlyn Jenner. Jesus God, what an embarrassment. I have yet to hear from or of a single trans person who thinks Caitlyn Jenner being governor of California would be a good idea. And most of them are rather unequivocal in suggesting that it would be a terrible idea. And so now, because of course, she shows up on that program hosted by Scam Hannity Job. The Hannity Job. And it's just terrible, awful. And in terms of, and they did this in front of some sort of live audience, this so-called interview. And what an awful. Just by way of for instancing, she addressed the problem of people experiencing homelessness in California. And this is truly stunningly thorn in the side stupid. Holy smokes. Homelessness. We know homelessness is a problem. And you know what? It's not a problem that's created by homeless people. People experiencing homelessness. In California and all over the United States, people experience homelessness because we choose to have a homelessness problem. It is absolutely solvable, but we choose not to fix it. Beginning with the foreclosure crisis of that was brought on by the reign of error of dim leader, which resulted in homes being foreclosed. That's why it's a foreclosure crisis. And which then in turn led people with lots of money to buy up a lot of property. And then you get the advent of Airbnb. So there is, and on top of that, a massive housing bubble in terms of cost. People can't afford homes. It is not complicated at all. But according to this terrible, no good, very bad, awful, just repulsive excuse for a human being, this failed attempt at humanity, talking to Hannity, you know, the insufferable talking to the intolerable, you get this.
California. My friends are leaving California. Actually, we're at my hangar. The guy across right over from me, he was packing up his hangar. I said, where are you going?
In his hangar, mind you. You know, where you put your fucking airplane or maybe your jet. His hangar. Just making that clear. That's all.
And he was packing up his hangar. I said, where are you going? And he says, I'm moving to Sedona, Arizona. I can't take it in anymore. I can't walk down the streets and see the homeless. I don't want to leave. Okay. Either I stay and fight or I get out of here.
I can't take it anymore. I can't walk down the streets and see the homeless. Jesus God. Because the homeless, you know, they give Caitlin a sad having to see them. Well, you know what? There's news coming out of South Carolina, Stan. One of the two houses of the South Carolina Stan state legislature has decided that South Carolina Stan doesn't have enough ways to kill people in the name of the state. And so I don't know if I'm not sure exactly procedurally where it is, if it's in committee or if it's been voted on by the full House and approved. But those wise souls have decided to add a firing squad to their list of acceptable manifestations of the death penalty. No, really. So maybe if Caitlin could become governor of California, she could, you know, sort of take some crib notes from South Carolina, Stan, and they could have firing squads for homeless people. Holy. And the whole thing was that kind of a hot mess. I don't think we can get our places, our heads to a place where we think about what this level of utterly self-absorbed, conscienceless sociopathy. Jesus God. And so Caitlin wants to stand and fight the homeless people, you know, for experiencing homelessness. Fuck me, Dad. And while she says she claims to have disavowed Nitwit Nero, she also apparently wants to rake the forests. Not kidding.
Gets away from them, they can't. And would you allow controlled burns? Isn't there a science behind forestry? Is that science being...
Imagine tuning into Fox and hearing Scam Hannity say, isn't there a science behind forestry? It is a science! It just hurts. It hurts my little pumpkin head. And all for votes from people she thinks are going to vote for her who despise her very existence. Yeah. Oh, by the way, she's also opposed, because we've talked about it a lot, she's opposed to trans kids competing and trans girls competing in girls' athletics. Doesn't give a shit about boys. Trans boys. Not even visible to her. They're very real, Caitlin. And they're not doing any harm either. But it's always about the trans girls. And so it turns out, I think, I mentioned this Tuesday evening. Caitlin competed against women in golf tournaments. Maybe when she had, I don't know, maybe she buzzed into Palm Springs or buzzed in, over to Pebble Beach in her aeroplane. Maybe she, I don't know, maybe she dropped a few grenades on some homeless people on the way. Ugh. What an embarrassment. You know, and it's not, she's not just an embarrassment to the trans community. She's an embarrassment to humanity. And it's naturally, the big interview is with the Hannity job. Because... well, of course.
That is a mighty, mighty empty, dry pickle barrel she came from the bottom of.
Ignored in this state?
Yes.
Because when I watch it, it breaks my heart. I lived in Santa Barbara. I watched Hope Ranch burn down after I had just left the state.
Yes. Yes, forest management is extremely important. Yeah. Just like at my house. And it's not even...
Just like at my forest. Fuck!
Forest management at my house. The reason my house made it, because they say you have to keep any brush 50 or 75 feet. I think I had 75 feet clearance.
And so, you know, I kidnapped a few homeless people and made them clear my brush, and I told them I would pay them afterward, but I stiffed them.
When the fires came, they just went around my house so fast, it was gone, because it's moving very fast. So it's almost the same thing for forest management, just a little bit of preparation, you know, and my house made it. But five houses around me were burnt.
And, you know, PG&E not burning down an entire city, that's really part of the program, too.
The ground. Lives were destroyed.
We now
gets away from them. They can't.
You know? Would you allow?
Yeah, what a genius. Honest to God, I wouldn't be surprised if I saw her putting on the Acme rocket skates. God. And P.S., because she's a fucking idiot, Dave number 11 reminds us. It's 100 feet, Kate. Yeah. And Lee pointing out, she wants to rape the forest. Didn't realize she was desperate for wood. Oh, that was bad. And Jack in Shreveport pointing out, Caitlin wins the Barbara Bush Award for not wanting to bother her pretty head with those types of things. I think Babs was talking in reference to Katrina victims in the Superdome. Yes. No, that was not the Katrina. She said, why would I trouble my beautiful mind? Because the question is, this was back when her son, the dim leader, was starting the Iraq war with people who never raised so much as a finger against us. And and the question was put to Babs. Well, I mean, are you worried about the number of American lives? And she said, and why would I worry my beautiful mind about that? How many died and where and how? Why would I do that? I think there's a little channeling going on here with Kate. Thanks, Jack. And by the way, just a couple of other notes. Because this sort of dovetails with something that happened earlier in my email today that is a perfect fit for Thorn in the Side Thursday. I get these stupid, unbearably ignorant press releases. The Daily Torch, brought to you by Americans for Limited Government. Critical race theory is getting crushed nationally. And suddenly they've got a teabagger crush or a maggot crush on Glenn Greenwald, one of the nation's most respected journalists, maybe by maggots for limited government, eviscerated the corporate media like the Washington Post and New York Times for being willing servants of anonymous intelligence or Justice Department officials. Yeah, okay. David Potter writes an article, Critical Race Theory is Getting Crushed Nationally. Well, by racists, maybe? I don't know. The anti-woke backlash is gaining momentum as more states and jurisdictions are rising against critical race theory. And it goes on stupidly from there. But I was reminded of that when I saw a note come in from our buddy Ron in Raleigh. Woke, I don't think that word means what you think it does, redux. This is really starting to piss me off. The link below is another diatribe by a woman, although she's Asian, thinks she's white. From Newsweek, Woke Racism Systemic Problem America, opinion by Helen Raleigh. America's woke left lectures the rest of the population almost daily that racism is evil and that they are the ones fighting it. Yet their ugly and racist reactions to Senator Tim Scott's speech demonstrate that the woke left is no different from the very racists they condemn. Well, at least she acknowledges that there are racists to condemn. There was a piece in yesterday's newspaper by Kathleen Parker, Ron and Raleigh continues, which says about the same thing the link to article says. White people, except for a rare few, do not have a fucking clue about the dynamics in the black community. Since I've been black most of my life, Ron notes, I need to explain something to these ignorant people who are not black. There have always been black people who believe that white people are the best thing since sliced bread. The closest representations in modern culture are Uncle Ruckus on Boondocks or Samuel L. Jackson's character in Django Unchained. What these heifers don't understand is that the black community has always called out our wayward brothers and sisters for wrong thinking, blaming woke racism, whatever the fuck that is, for how we in the black community have addressed Senator Scott is just bullshit. And I might add that Senator Tim Scott was the one who actually used the phrase Uncle Tom in his own speech. And then he was hoisted on his own petard. I will guarantee, Ron continues, neither of these women, Kathleen Parker or Helen Raleigh, have spent any appreciable time interacting with black people. What is going on is a continued whitewashing of racism by white people and their lickspittle fellow travelers in minority communities. I'm going to go eat dirt and run some of the cute little rabbits in my yard. I know. And here it is, a thing. This bullshit white wing critique of wokeness. And meanwhile, you know how the right wing has this habit of putting forth opinion pieces as letters to the editor, and they're all over the place. Well, Ron found an example of that in the Charlotte News and Observer. Resisting arrest is a capital crime. When I tried to find the letter, I found similar letters in newspapers all over the country. All these letters were written by white men. I want one of these privileged assholes to tell me how could George Floyd or Eric Garner have been able to not resist any more than they did. Anthony Brown was shot from behind 4 times in the arm and the kill shot to the back of the head. He had both hands on the wheel. How could he have resisted less? Philando Castile was shot while in the driver's seat of his car trying to show the policeman who shot him his gun permit. I could go on, but why should I? These letters show that a large swath of white men think that black people are treated the same way they are, and the only sympathy they have is for the white cops that perform executions for the crime of resisting arrest. Right. Which, you know, cops don't get to be judge, jury, and executioner. They're not supposed to be any one of those three at all. And yet, somehow or another, we manage to tolerate them doing so. And way back in the 1980s, Ron adds, as to homelessness, I worked for an architectural firm that did design and admin on farmers' home housing projects. These projects were funded by joint funding from the federal government, state government, and localities. These affordable projects came to a screeching halt under the Reagan administration. Since then, the federal government hasn't built a stick of housing. This is just one more example of how old 666, Ronald Wilson Reagan, well and truly fucked this country. And how, but good. So as you can see, it's rather a busy, or potentially busy, thorn in the side Thursday. And I just don't have the stomach to play any more of Kate. And frankly, I was trying to come up with a way to express how awful she is. And based on something Matt in San Francisco wrote the other day, I think I came up with it. Caitlyn Jenner is the Tim Scott of Milo Yiannopoulos. And that indeed is a mighty, mighty deep, dry basement with a deep, dry pickle barrel in the bottom of it. And I know everybody said, ah, don't worry, she doesn't have a chance. Ugh. I think it was on Friday on the front porch, maybe a couple of weeks ago, when we went over the dynamics of the process whereby a recall election is generated. And the only way there is no chance is if she is not on the ballot. And it's terrifying. Oh, by the way, Billable Rick says, yeah, I agree. Fuck the Gatorade. I'm now fully vaccinated as of 7 p.m. last night. Moderna, part deux. I've gotten by just fine without drinking Gatorade. My go-to's been mineral water mixed with orange juice. So far, my main symptoms have been a headache and slight fever, which goes away with Advil, and some transitory muscle aches. Trans muscle aches? Billable Rick, is there something you need to tell us? No big deal. It's a small sacrifice in order to return to semi-normalcy. Semi. Because we still have to be careful with about our masks. Because variants. Because maggots. Because unvaccinated. Good God. I saw a story earlier today where some bizarre maggot asshole, I presume, a gang of them. Well, they had themselves a rally. And in Morani, Utah Stan, on the first day of May, and they had an effigy of a needle, a syringe, which they burned. Yep, right wingers have gone from burning crosses to burning effigies. Yeah.
All right. We are in Moroni, Utah. Before
Moron.
This, like, how many people really cared about vaccines? I didn't. But now, this is a big, giant needle. We're in Moroni, Utah.
You already said that.
And when government and mainstream media and every single powerful celebrities, every person on TV, actors, this is a giant needle. Medical tyranny.
Yeah, because their giant syringe is labeled medical tyranny. Because trying to stop a pandemic that has killed millions, that has killed almost 600,000 Americans, is medical tyranny. Never mind the fact that today it was announced that we reached a 7-month low in COVID cases, in large part because of the vaccine. But no, this was a night of liberty. Sit, liberty, sit. And this is why it's going to be so goddamned hard to reach herd immunity. Ambitiously, the Biden administration has announced the goal of having 70% immunization by July. Do you think the maggots might get vaccinated if you offered them a free maggot hat? Wouldn't that be ironic? The government spending money on MAGA hats just to get the goddamned idiot maggots to get their shot. Medical tyranny.
Huh.
Okay, guys, where we're at, we're in Moroni, Utah, and we're having a...
Not the best color commentator. That's his third "we're in Moroni, Utah." Skip a bit, brother.
This is awesome.
That's awesome.
Pretty warm, huh? Isn't it? Is that pretty warm?
Back up. Come on, back
up. And they're, you know, butthole the belly button, not a mask among them, LARPing and smolicking, nobody's vaccinated. What a great place to have it. Moroni, Utah. It's causing global warming, this bonfire. It's like 10 dead polar bears right there. Yeah, dang. And the dude doing the babbling, by the way, in case you're wondering, is a former police officer, because of course, from Salt Lake City, by the name of Eric Moutsos, M-O-U-T-S-O-S. And among other things, back in 2014, he refused to work at the Salt Lake City Pride Parade. So you get a pretty good idea who this jackass is. Yeah. Because we don't need no stinking vaccines. I never thought about vaccines before. Did you ever think about it? I didn't think about no vaccines. Wonder if he's got kids. Wonder if those kids are in public school. Because at some point in time, he had to think about vaccines if that's the case. I don't know. It's Utah. Maybe not. As to Caitlin, a question coming in from Scott in San Diego. How long ago did she undergo her trans procedure? I don't know what procedure she's had, frankly. But it was a while back. Apparently, she's had a lot of face work done. I don't know. Once upon a time, a main requirement before things could get underway was intensive psychological work. One couldn't simply walk in, take a number, and get her or M done. It hasn't been that long ago that Bruce became Caitlin, so with all that pre-op psychological investigation she had, how could they miss that she obviously doesn't have reality on speed dial? Oh, I know, and there were other clips. But the fact of the matter, that is a hard and fast and unbreakable rule. You don't question somebody's transness, and I don't question hers. But Jesus, what a horrible human being. But she's been that since before she came out. The whole grift that she ran with her famous for being famous, privileged, can't really figure out what makes them family. Ugh. But a good point. But frankly, the purpose of the counseling is not to determine whether one is or what one's mental health status is, but rather to establish that there is that the patient is able to sanely make the decision. And it's called gatekeeping, and it's pretty awful, really. It's a tremendous cost. And you don't undertake it lightly. Because it's not exactly a whole lot of fun. It's what you do to survive. As to the huge needle, Lee in New York wants to know, was the eye of that needle big enough for a camel to pass through? Asking for an evangelical who hopes to get into heaven. Oh, I know. I don't think it's not a sewing needle, so it doesn't have an eye. It's just hollow. Oh, dear, dear Scott, says Steve in New York. Those psychological evals don't apply to those with money. And that's absolutely true. If you can pay cash for your surgical procedures, there are plenty of talented surgeons, not plenty, but a good number of them, who will do it, no questions asked. If I had the cash, I could get it done quickly. But I don't, and I want insurance to cover, so I have to jump through the flaming barbed wire hoops. And that's just how it is. And serving as the Horn Ad Hoc Research Department, Ralph lets us know that she came out in July of 2015. And more than anything else, what I would like to see, there are some other things I'd like to see. But I would like it very much if ESPN would rescind that humanitarian award that they gave her. You remember all the kerfuffle and the carrying on and the room full of people just clapping wildly for her? Yeah, it's time to recall that. Because it's pretty clear that she's trashed it. Going back to South Carolina, Stan, and their firing squad, which has not become law, Ralph's also let us know that it hasn't happened quite yet. As Brother Deacon Asa pointed out, firing squads, South Carolina, I'll bet you at 20 that Alabama or Mississippi will pass public stoning legislation to outdo South Carolina. Well, it's good enough for the Bible, it's good enough for us. And remember, upon challenge, it is not sufficient to prove that it is cruel or that it is unusual. It has to be both cruel and unusual. And so, you know, you may succeed on one and fail on the other. Well, you know, I mean, come on. It's South Carolina. Ain't nothing unusual about them trying to figure out novel ways to kill people. They lobbed shells at a federal fort in Charleston Harbor. Come on. In Alabama, please. Don't even. Yeah, right. Like I said, busy damn day. And I've got another, I don't know if this caught your notice, but it grabbed my eye when I saw it. A little blip on the news radar yesterday. The Justice Department has filed an appeal of a U.S. District Court judge for the D.C., for the District of Columbia. The judge has overturned the CDC's federal eviction moratorium. It's been repeatedly extended as we have continued to be burned up by this pandemic, this avoidable pandemic that we have only thanks to COVID Caligula and his malignant negligence. Under the new Biden administration, the CDC was trying to extend the moratorium. And so as of a week ago yesterday, Judge Dabney Friedrich sided with the plaintiffs. Yeah, somebody actually sued saying we need to get these evictions going. Who was that who filed the lawsuit? Well, it was the Alabama Association of Realtors. Because, of course. And they filed in the District of Columbia, because seat of government, against the Department of Health and Human Services et al., claiming that they had a terrible, terrible sad because they weren't able to shit on people and throw them out of their homes during a pandemic. Now, you may ask yourself, gee, what kind of a shitheel judge would issue such a ruling? Well, that's when I decided to go and Dabney Friedrich. And I was thinking of Dabney Coleman, but no. Dabney Langhorne Friedrich. God, you got to wonder if she's kin to Mark Twain somehow. On the Langhorne side. She is, she's 54 years old, Dabney Friedrich is. And she has sat in the past on the U.S. Sentencing Commission. She must have been a real blast there. And she was appointed to the U.S. Sentencing Commission first by George W. Bush and then maintained in office by Barack Obama. And she's got herself at one of those real highfalutin legal educations. She got her B.A. from Trinity University. She got her first law degree from University College Oxford, and that ain't Oxford, Mississippi. And then she got her actual, no kidding, American law degree, her Juris Doctor, from Yale University. She was born in Pensacola, Florida, and she was the senior editor of the Yale Journal on Regulation, and she had she was a law clerk for a D.C. trial court judge, a D.C. district judge, by the name of Thomas F. Hogan. And was appointed by, wait for it, old 666 himself, Ronald Wilson Reagan. So, Judge Dabney Friedrich has a long history of shitting on people. And how, you might ask, did she get to the United States District Court for the District of Columbia? Ha! Well, funny you'd ask. She was appointed by Nitwit Nero. Yeah. How about that? Nitwit Nero. And then she went right out and did the very sort of thing that a Nitwit Nero judge would do. Telling the federal government that they cannot protect people during a pandemic by making sure that they aren't thrown out on the streets, where they will, of course, spread the disease and perhaps even die themselves. Because free market, right? A president who was a grifty, redlining, color bar, racist, son of a Klansman, slumlord appointed someone who would shit on people who were trying to stay in their homes. Yeah, you know what? Elections have consequences. In her opinion, Dabney Friedrich wrote, the pandemic has triggered difficult policy decisions that have had enormous real-world consequences. The nationwide eviction moratorium is one such decision. It is the role of the political branches and not the courts to assess the merits of policy measures designed to combat the spread of the disease, even during a global pandemic. The question for the court is a narrow one. Does the Public Health Service Act grant the CDC the legal authority to impose a nationwide eviction moratorium? It does not. Science doesn't matter. Very lives themselves don't matter. What matters is the Alabama Realtors Association of Montgomery, Alabama. Stan. This is why we can't have nice things. Remember at the beginning of the program? At the beginning of the program, I pointed out that homelessness is not an accident. It is not a function of some sort of law of nature. Homelessness is a choice that we make. It is a choice that a culture decides. It is something that a culture decides to have or not have. Well, hi, Dabney Friedrich, your fucking honor. You disease spreader in a black robe. Because that's what she is. There weren't no moratoriums on there weren't no more of them moratoriums on pandemics when the framers framed the Constitution, because I'm an originalist. Ain't none of the government's business. You know, for fuck's sake. So that's pretty much the filibuster for this Thorn in the Side Thursday. And I need to say a couple of I need to offer up a thank you. Because the Fuck the Gatorade Challenge has been met. Thank you, Jeremy. And the and Jessica's Bullseye Challenge has been met. Thank you, Ralphs. So that means that we are actually down to only 810 to go to come up even with this far into the week and not have some sort of monumental, humongous community-made miracle to try to pull together during Friday on the front porch tomorrow. Let's see, if we get down to, if we crank out, if we can come up with another $120, then we won't be facing a $1,000 community-made miracle tomorrow evening. As the more we knock out, the better off we'll be. So I'm going to go to the phones in a minute, but it is Thursday, and we do have the Green News Report, so I'm inclined to go with that, and then we'll come back and get into some conversation. Okay?
It's Thursday, May 6, 2021.
The new climate normals are out today, and they show a daunting trend.
The Earth's new normal is hotter than it used to be, thanks to global warming.
Thanks, global warming!
A new study has discovered glaciers are melting at two times the rate most experts had predicted.
Alarming new news for the planet's glaciers.
Thanks to global warming.
California accuses Nestle of stealing millions of gallons of water. Plus, Biden cancels Trump's border wall funding.
All of that cancel culture and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Climate deniers complain that doing anything is doing too much, but we just learned the price of doing nothing. One insurance company estimates that climate change could cut the world economy by $23 trillion in 2050. As crop yields fall, disease spreads, and rising seas consume coastal cities. It's not a good sign when your insurance company sounds like the Book of Revelation.
This is your Green News Report.
That explains this new ad.
Geico. 15 minutes could save you from the dragon whose tail will sweep the stars from the sky, and lo, the lamb will break the seventh seal.
Repent, sinners!
Okay, Desi Doyen, more Thanks, global warming stories today?
Yes, unfortunately. So NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, measures global climate trends using averages over 30-year periods. This week, NOAA updated its 30-year average and, surprise, confirms that average global temperatures have increased 1 degree Celsius since 1901. Extreme rainfall events are also increasing in frequency and intensity, all thanks to man-made global warming.
Thanks, global warming.
NOAA warns that the increases in temperature and extreme weather events have huge implications for everything from agriculture to infrastructure. In America, our average new normal temperature is also a full degree hotter than it was just 20 years ago, with the southern half of the country seeing particularly sharp increases in temperature. Up north, too, Fairbanks, Alaska is no longer designated a subarctic climate and will now be classified as a warm summer continental climate.
Oh, man. And that's one of the reasons I guess we've seen warmer temperatures sometimes in Fairbanks, Alaska than we've seen down here in Los Angeles.
Exactly. Meanwhile, new satellite data shows that nearly all of the world's 220,000 glaciers are melting faster than ever, and the rate of melting is also accelerating. A new study has found the Earth lost 30% more ice every year from 2015 to 2019 compared to the previous 5 years. And it matters, because in areas like densely populated India that rely on glacier melt for their drinking water, that faster rate raises the risk of water shortages.
Oh, man.
And deadly glacial outburst floods in mountain communities when glaciers collapse.
That's going to be a huge problem.
But the biggest threat to global stability is the glacier's contribution to rising sea levels, according to CBS meteorologist Jeff Berardelli.
We have pretty much locked in over 20 feet of sea level rise. It is going to happen no matter what we do. What really matters is how fast the sea level goes up. If it goes up very fast, then we cannot adapt as a human race fast enough. It causes a lot of international instability. But if we allow it to happen slowly, which is what we're trying to do, then over the course of hundreds of years, we can adapt to that more gradual sea level rise.
And yeah, none of us will be here by then anyway, so who cares?
In other news, a new analysis by ProPublica has identified major problems in California's forest carbon offset program, which allows polluting companies to pay forest owners for keeping their trees intact to store carbon in order to offset the polluters' emissions. The program has generated nearly $2 billion in revenue. However, ProPublica's new research shows that California's oversimplified system doesn't account for actual carbon absorption by different types of forests, finding many aren't actually achieving real carbon reductions at all. But it's still allowing companies that buy the forest offsets to justify polluting even more, actually increasing emissions.
Good for ProPublica getting that story out.
Yes. Also in California, regulators have accused bottled water giant Nestle of draining millions of gallons more water out of the public's San Bernardino National Forest than it is entitled to as drought conditions worsen across the state. A 2017 investigation found Nestle has withdrawn 25 times more water than is allowed by its permit, for which Nestle pays just $2,100 per year.
Per year. And then how much do they charge you for that bottled water they stole from California?
Finally, a bit of good news. President Biden is canceling funding for construction of ex-President Donald Trump's controversial southern border wall. The White House says some of the leftover funding will be used to help reverse the environmental damage caused by construction of the wall.
Good. That is a little bit of good news. A very little bit, but we'll take it. Much more on that story and all of the other ones we couldn't get to today at our website, greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
All in all, it's just another brick in the wall. All in all, you're just
And so we are here into the second hour of the program. And thanks to Brad and Desi for that. Let me make sure we're not going to have any feedback. And Darlene wanted to know, did Judge Friedrich come from the Trinity in Connecticut, or the Trinity in Texas? And the answer is, of course, she is a Republican piece of trash. So she came from the, she was born in Florida and came from the Trinity in San Antonio, Texas. Okay? And like I said, we are down to $810 to go in terms of funding the program up to this evening. And by the way, with a good observation, Judge Froedrich, Steve notes, that judge wrote that the political branches should determine these things and not the courts. Then why did she do what she did? Or did I hear this all? No, you didn't. You heard it absolutely correctly. It's not for the courts to decide this. And therefore, I'm going to decide this because small government and originalism and all that other silly horse shit. Right. I don't know. Is Dabney a trans woman? Billable asks. She seems to have a large head. Would you be surprised if I told you that Dabney worked in the counsel's office of the Bush White House? I wonder if she worked with torture czars John Yoo and Jay Bybee while there. Did Dabney have a hand in writing the torture memos? The sanction for Yoo and Bybee authoring the torture memos was that the former became a tenured law professor at UC Berkeley, Bolt Hall, and the latter became a Ninth Circuit judge. That's some punishment. Failing upward, it's what maggots and wingnuts do. Mm-hmm. Oh, wow, congratulations. Ralph says, I graduated from Trinity University in 1978 in San Antonio. Congratulations. Wonderful. That's great to hear. I was not trying to imply that all people or that everybody, but, you know, the Florida, Texas, you know, wingnuts. Yeah, I apologize. I probably should have worded that more carefully. Or not at all. Let's check in with Scott. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Hey there, you with the stars in your eyes. Love never made a fool of you. You used to be too wise.
Great lyric.
Having a Rosemary Clooney moment.
They happen.
I like her version of that tune best.
Well, it's like, what it was, May 1st was a perfect day, and I was having a Nat King Cole moment.
Mona Lisa, Mona
no,
Lisa.
No. What a day this has been. What a rare mood I'm in. Why, it's almost like being in love.
Yeah, God, Nat Cole could sing a song, and he was not a bad piano player.
Oh, he was a right spiffy piano player.
That's how he was known prior to becoming a well-known vocalist. And his brother, who died, I believe, earlier this year, Freddie Cole, and his niece, is it his niece or his daughter, Natalie?
Natalie was his daughter.
His daughter. All of the Cole people could sing.
I guess it ran in the family.
Yeah. Freddie, if you didn't know that it wasn't Nat King Cole singing, in other words, a song composed after 1965, when Nat passed away, you wouldn't realize that it wasn't Nat King Cole singing. But anyway, that's neither here nor there.
Oh. But something motivated you to make the call.
Wait a minute. Right now I got to clear my throat. Hang on just a second.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Gotta use the mute button. Let me take another sip of coffee. Maybe that's the problem. Yes. Why did I call? Well, I'll tell you why I called, Robin. Wait a minute. That's great coffee.
Glad you like it.
Just to touch base and say hello and stuff. One good thing. If there is a
Well, of course, lining. Dimitri, I like to call and say hello.
One good thing about the ruling by this, twit judge, Froedrich, or whatever.
Froedrich.
Froedrich. I like Froedrich better.
That's good.
Fraud as in ain't real, and Reich as in
third.
The third. Judge Froedrich? come on down. You're the next contestant on Fuck the Poor. Anyway, where the hell was I going? Oh yes, the silver lining in this non-eviction or this pro-eviction ruling. I think there are 18 states, or maybe all but 18 states. Now, it's more likely that there are just 18 states whose non-eviction rules this does not affect. And I know that California is one of them. They listed them on the news the other night. But still, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, when you're dealing with a pandemic of historic proportions, and it has thrown a wrench into the lives of millions of people here and abroad, why is a ruling like this, the need for a ruling like this, bumped up to the top of the fucking list? Answer me that, Judge Fraudreich.
Well, originalism or something like that. Right.
Well, it just chafes my thighs when I hear stuff like this. You know, I mean, really. And another thing, I'm on Facebook, and I'm seeing friends of mine, some of them literally lifelong friends, on Facebook, who I know to be true progressives and decent people running to the defense of Representative Cheney. She is not our friend, folks.
She's not. I mean, I understand the degree of sympathy she may, if sympathy is the word that she may engender. Our pal Kevin in Massachusetts pointed out the other night, here's to Liz Cheney. She's out of fucks to give and tells the truth about January 6th and the 2020 election. She knows she's on the way out and couldn't care less. And to that extent, yeah, I will. Because the new replacement is that god-awful Elise Stefanik maggot out of New York. Remember her from the first impeachment trial? Or from the first impeachment? And how she's not even from her own district, but she became an early favorite of Nitwit Nero as far as impeachment was concerned.
Elise Stefanik is a real superstar of the Republican Party,
and so now she's outrunning her gob about how the world should be run. Let me see. What is the? Let me look. What was the poll quote? It was a dandy. I mean, it was certainly worthy of it was worthy of maggotness. Among other things, she ran her gob over how unfair it was to take committee assignments away from Marjorie Traitor Greene. But that's how you become famous in maggot land now, by saying hateful, odious, and awful things.
But was it when she was first appearing on the scene politically? Let's go back to 2015, 2016. Wasn't she originally a never Trumper? Can the research department look that up?
She was seen as being at least somewhat rational, but then she figured out which side of the bread they'd put the butter on, and it had MAGA scraped into the toast.
So it wasn't a massive head injury. It was opportunity is knocking. I better go answer.
Yeah, this is, you know, basically this is a great grift.
Yeah, Jesus.
And how bad is it? It's, you know, what I guess the way this works is you can only say you can only speak truth about Republicans and maggots if you no longer hold office. So, for instance, former Representative Joe Walsh of Illinois launched into her such utter bullshit. At least Donald Trump doesn't know the first fucking thing about the Constitution. Because she had recently abased herself and said, he's the strongest supporter of the Constitution.
The only reason he likes the word is as part of the word is tit. Okay? I mean, other than that, I don't think I would defend.
I would say only you, but I think that probably was occurring to other people as well.
Well, I mean, here's the deal. You know how in grade school we used to have spelling bees?
Yeah.
And every year they have the Scripps National Spelling Championship.
Yes.
If you had little Donnie Trump, even grown up Donnie Trump, President Trump, former president, ex-president, sorry he ever was President Trump, in a spelling bee, I doubt that he could spell Constitution. You know?
Oh, sure. No, absolutely not.
And you know he's never read it. And even if he read the fucking classic comic books version of the Constitution, along with this Prince Valiant classic comics, he wouldn't understand it. You know, just dumber than a box of rusty doorknobs, Robin. I mean, not you, but...
No, I get your point.
I get so tired of these fuckers. And it's going to continue getting worse. It
is exhausting. Yes, it absolutely is. You know, we got
better.
It was Trump fatigue, and then it was pandemic fatigue, and now it's maggot insurrection fatigue. There's no end of fatigue with these people, and it's on purpose.
And you know that they're not dealing with it in terms of the rest of us are just shells of our former selves. Been run through the goddamn ringer and have no, our psyches have all been battered over not just the 4 years of Trump, but now the last over calendar year of this fucking pandemic. And they're not buffeted about by reality and the conditions that the rest of us have to dance with. Hell no. And
go.
I'm just thinking, Republicans once upon a time didn't all march in mindless lockstep. There were a few moderate Republicans and independent thinkers. As a matter of fact, a lot of them prided themselves. Well, and we used to have it in the Democratic Party also. People who prided themselves on thinking for themselves, but sometimes setting aside their personal wishes to attend to a job at hand, which in this case is making it through this goddamn 4 years of Trump and now the goddamn pandemic. Or am I putting too fine a point or missing something here?
No, Ron? No. It's gotten to the point where we're amazed when we find any Republicans thinking at all, let alone for themselves, without just thinking. Instead of just grunting and punching the no button.
And you're right about they somehow come back to a recognizable form of reality after they leave office. Well, that's too goddamn late. You can't, other than write a book to bemoan the fact that you had to deal with assholes back when you were in office and become a highly paid talking head on a cable news network, you've missed your opportunity to make a discernible difference, Mr. or Ms. Elected official of the GOP persuasion. And I guess they know this. I mean, because it's all about the ducats. When it comes down to it, the heads of the different parties control the spigot when it comes to, you know, the senatorial reelection committee on the Republican side and the congressional reelection committee on the, you know, Democratic side or whatever. It all comes down to the almighty dollar, shekel, Deutschmark, franc, pound, euro, et cetera, et al.
Well,
I guess you could.
Look, I mean, here, okay, so, no, so here's what got Liz Cheney in such deep shit. She wrote the following. History is watching. Our children are watching. We must be brave enough to defend the basic principles that underpin and protect our freedom and democratic process. I'm committed to doing that, no matter what the short-term political consequences might be. And that's really kind of banal in the grand scheme of things. It's sort of an of course. But in the modern Republican Party, well, John Avalon over at CNN described it as a declaration of conscience for our times. A Republican,
you know,
a Republican behaving marginally decently is a declaration of conscience for our times. I mean, this isn't only Nixon could go to fucking China, okay?
Yeah.
Sorry, F-bomb. I mean, it is. It's what any decent human being who's a citizen of this country should be saying. But in a Republican world led by nitwit Nero and administered by, you know, that unrepentant, unreconstructed old Confederate turtle, Mitch McConnell, it's a declaration of conscience for our times. And I mean, I get it. Okay, praise them when they get something right. Sure. You know, just like, you know, when your three-year-old doesn't shit their pants. Yay, you. But isn't that what this is? Because I know what Liz Cheney's politics are. She's horrible. She's dick in a wig.
Dick in a wig? Is that like cock in a box? No, I get what you mean. But in the final analysis, isn't it farting against thunder? In a thunderstorm, you can let one, and it is audible on some level. But against the majesty and noise factor of thunder, it's as if it never happened. And whatever pronouncement Ms. Cheney makes, you know, it makes no discernible difference in the makeup and nature of the GOP as currently constituted. You know, she may as well go out and open a flower shop or a record store or a coffee house or something, because for all her, you know, courageous pronouncements, she's not there to help us.
Right. And it, you know, you got to remember that, you know, numbers, statistics, Dick in a wig voted with nitwit Nero almost 93%. Well, now Elise Stefanik, freaking moron, 78%. As far as the American Conservative Union, which I guess is, you know, the clearinghouse for one's legitimate, honest-to-goodness, small government conservatism, well, Dick in a Wig is 78%, while Elise, the opportunist, doesn't quite reach 44%. But suddenly, she's the one who is going to carry the mantle of MAGA-try for the Republicans as the head of their caucus in the House.
Well, they needed someone in a hurry because they couldn't have Ms. Cheney out there, you know, speaking truth to power or whatever the hell she was doing. It's just so transparently inauthentic. The whole thing, I mean, from soup to nuts, that party, well, you can't even call it a party in the sense of, gee whiz, Robin.
It's a cult.
Well, welcome to the party. We anticipate having a great time while you're here. It's not a party in terms of a group of people with a clear mindset and a conscience destined to get positive and appropriate things done. They haven't been that, if they ever were that, you know?
No. And here's a perfect analogy. Ponder this, says Stephen New York. If Rudolf Hess acknowledged that, yes, Hitler did actually intend to carry out the Holocaust, how brave he is. That's Liz Cheney, you know, no. Queen of the obvious. And she's saying what she's saying because she thinks there's some sort of market that might lead her to be America's first woman president.
I will be America's first woman president before she will. Come on. I mean, it just troubles me that things are at this state. And maybe I was a fool to buy into any notion that they're ever going to get better. I don't know that they will in my lifetime, which is rapidly going through the sands are dribbling through the old, upright and above ground hourglass. I used to think.
Don't hurry yourself along.
No, I won't. But what I'm saying is that there was a time when I could be a relentless optimist with some degree of satisfaction that my optimism would be rewarded in reality. But I just don't know that it's ever going to happen. And that makes me sad, Robin. That makes me awfully sad. That to whatever extent I have participated in being part of the solution as opposed to part of the problem has been in some ways like farting against thunder. And it makes me sad. It makes me angry. It pisses me off that things are set up in such a way that none of us, you know, we're all in this together. And there are forces against which we are battling on an ongoing basis that are so entrenched and so powerful that they're always going to win in the long run. They may give us one every now and again. You know, I mean, even on your birthday, if you're married, you get an extra treat. You know, I'm not going to get any more explicit than that. You know, but they may allow us one from time to time. But in the long run, The all of this is hardwired in, and I'm sorry to put it that way, but it just upsets me. And maybe that's what, you know, maybe that's a good thing. And it isn't that I'm negative. You know, some people only see the dark side. I can't sit back and say, well, gee, look how far we've come when there's so far to go. Yes, I acknowledge how far we've come to the extent that we have. But it is like, what is the most difficult, odious job in the world? It's like pushing that rock up the, who's Sisyphus? Is that the guy with the rock?
I think it's, yeah.
It's like put every day, your job one, to quote the old Ford Motor Company, quality is job one. Job one for that poor suffering bastard was at bottom of the ravine with a big old boulder the size of a VW Beetle. And the object of the exercise that day and every day was push that fucking rock up to the top of the summit there. And every day he would, and then he'd wake up the next day after an evening of Miller Time and other delights, only to be at the bottom of the ravine staring at that goddamn rock. I don't know, maybe today wasn't the day for me to call because I'm listening to myself, my otherwise upbeat, happy self being, just disgusted. I mean, just absolutely disgusted at how stupid we, I say we human beings, have been to allow things to get to this point. We should be way further along in our national enterprise in terms of positive, appropriate, world-changing things, and we have just fiddle-fucked ourselves into you know, but otherwise everything's cool. I mean,
not everything. I mean, you've got the stupid recall coming up. It's kind of like Flavio mentioned. Never underestimate a California referendum. Arnold Schwarzenegger announced his candidacy in the 2003 California recall election for governor of California on the August 6, 2003 episode of The Tonight Show with Jay Leno.
Yeah, I remember that.
And he had the most name recognition in a crowded field of candidates, but he'd never held public office, and his political views were unknown to most Californians. His candidacy immediately became national and international news, with media outlets dubbing him the governator, the running man. They dubbed the recall election Total Recall. Okay?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if you can, I mean, if you can oil up and go on national television and take off your shirt and make your upper frontals dance in time with the music, you too can be governor of the Golden State. Is that how far the qualifications have fallen?
And he was one
of those crazy Republicans, Robin. I mean, he was a fairly reasonable person in some ways.
Precisely.
You know what, let's do. I know that a number of the members of the Horn family were active back during the last election cycle in Georgia, and their hard work helped to get Senator Ossoff and Senator, I can't think of his name, the preacher who has Martin Luther King's church, Warnock.
Reverend Warnock, Reverend Senator
their
Warnock.
Their hard work, literal hard work, made that possible. It gave us the Georgia miracle, if you will. This recall is just that important.
Well, it absolutely is, because as Flavio continues to point out, 55.4% of the vote favored recalling Gray Davis in 2003. And then Schwarzenegger became governor with 48.6% of the vote. That's terrifying.
Yeah. And it was absolutely needless.
The anti-vaxxers and various other maggots will joyfully vote to remove to remove Gavin Newsom, you know, just because, you know, just MAGA. And then when you get to question two, all bets are fucking off. I'm not predicting anything. God knows I don't want that for your adopted beloved state.
Well, I'm going to do everything I can.
But she's just getting warmed up. I mean, obviously, there's nothing I can do. But I would knock on doors and say, hi, I'm trans as fuck. Don't vote for that trans woman.
Yeah. Yeah, and just to be clear, earlier in my email, I wasn't knocking her or anybody's choice.
No. One's reality is what one's reality is.
Yeah, all I was saying was, you know, with the pre-op screening, psychological screening that's done, and I know the emphasis is not on your politics, but certainly somebody should have noticed that. As well-meaning as one might be in one area of endeavor, there are other endeavors that still need work. You know, it's like Cool Hand Luke. What did the prison boss say to Cool Hand Luke? What we have here is
failure to communicate.
Yeah.
Yeah, I need 50 eggs.
Oh, God. You know, it was a long time after seeing that film back when it was in the theater back in 68. It was a long time before I had another hard-boiled egg. That show put me off hard-boiled eggs for quite a long while. Thank you, Ms. Robin.
Although I've got to, but lately I've been having, and I got to do it. I'll make them soon, but I had a terrible hankering for my deviled eggs. I make a mean deviled egg.
My mama made deviled eggs. You would weep. They were so good.
They're not pretty because they're a little too, the stuffing is a little too chunky with like pickles and onions and stuff to get through a pastry bag. But damn the flavor. Yeah. And what I want to do now is I want to make them and a lot of people put a little paprika on the top just for pretty color. I use Old Bay, and it's not just color but flavor too. What I'm excited about now is to make some deviled eggs and use that umami seasoning on them from Aldi.
Oh no, what is that like a spicy a peppery sort of deal?
No, it's not hot at all. It's just this umami flavor explosion.
Hmm.
And it's absolutely delightful. And I've just been thinking, that would probably be really good on a deviled egg.
It's like an enhancement to taste and flavors and textures.
Yeah, and now that I've found that I can get this wonderful French M-I-E-L-L-E mustard on my local grocer shelves, that makes me even more excited because that stuff's like a cross between whatever you think mustard is and that evil, sinus-burning Chinese restaurant mustard.
Oh, God.
And it's heavenly.
And what is it called? Millie mustard?
Mie, M-I-E-L-L-E. It's a really, really, really old mustard brand from France.
Mie.
And it puts Grey Poupon to shame.
Oh, I wouldn't caulk my windows with Grey Poupon. I kept seeing the commercials, the limousines meeting at the light.
Yeah. Remember when the Wingnuts had a hissy back in the aughts over Barack Hussein Obama eating that fancy French mustard?
Grey Poupon. I didn't like it. It tasted nasty to me.
Oh, I like it. I like it well enough, but this stuff's even better.
I'm a Golden's man.
Nah. No, I mean, I can, but no, this stuff's just one. And in fact, the private selection label at Kroger or Ralph's or whatever,
yeah.
I think it may be manufactured by that French company because it's hotter by far than Grey Poupon and a lot closer in character to this stuff. And Chris in Germany turned me on to the M-I-E-L-L-E because she got me a pot of it at the M-I-E-L-L-E store, and it has a cork in the top and came with this cute little wooden spoon. Just wonderful.
I never get packages like that. I'm sorry, you made me laugh, or I made me laugh.
Well, good. And by the way, you got a cowbell from Billable Rick. For suggesting you'll be the first trans woman president. And by the way, Steve in New York said, I was thinking the same thing. Where the hell is optimistic Scotty? Hearing him as pessimistic Pollyanna just ain't right.
Well, I know, and it bugs me too, you know? See, you folks only get it during the course of my occasional calls to the program. I got to live with this every day. It's time for me to watch it's a mad, 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 mad world, or, you know.
You're down two mads. It's a mad, 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 mad world.
Well, whatever it is, I got to watch it. I've got the definitive Blu-ray version of that came out a couple of years ago, and it's on Criterion. Next time Criterion has a sale, go ahead and avail yourself of that opportunity, because it is the definitive version of it's a mad, 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 mad world.
Oh, and by the way, I've been called a fucking hillbilly elitist by Steve in New York. Miel mustard. Fucking hillbilly elitist. Yeah, right. Snob mustard. I'm a snobster.
Well, if you're from the hills, anything what got a cork in the top is good.
It's the cork, you know? Yeah, right. And I lost the cork and replaced it with a dried corn cob.
Well, there you go, Granny. Hand me the jug. I want to snort at that. But anyway, yeah, and Steve in New York, I get it. Normally, I am upbeat and positive and stuff. And maybe I shouldn't spend time thinking, because that's what gets me into trouble. But I watch the, you know, the PBS NewsHour, and I watch the news, and I read stuff online. And just when I think that we're getting, you know, making some progress, there's always some ass.
No, fuck no, we're not.
What?
Hey, we're making progress. No, fuck no, we're not. Not going to be any progress here.
Push that rock, you sweaty fucker, you. It's Sisyphus. Who's the guy that had the lantern looking for one honest man in the world? Who was that? Wasn't there a Greek fellow that was into that? Not Sophocles. Who the hell was that? I can't keep my Greeks situated correctly. But that's been a long-standing problem with me. pardon me. God damn, I'm cracking myself up with no need to do it. Let me ask you this, speaking of lanterns. The universal symbol for a person having an idea is to see a headshot of them with a light bulb floating above their head. Will you agree to that?
Yeah.
Prior to the invention of the light bulb, what appeared above someone's head when they had a new idea? Was it a lantern? Was it a stick with flame coming out of one end? What? Or am I just thinking of things that needn't be thought of in these times? I need to think of a more needful stuff.
Yeah, Diogenes was the one looking for the one honest man.
Diogenes, God.
Yeah, Sisyphus and the rock.
Yeah.
The Greeks had a thing about rocks because I always get my Sisyphus and my, Prometheus mixed up because they both had, Sisyphus, let's just make sure I've got, he had to roll an immense boulder up a hill forever. Whereas Prometheus got strapped to one, and I'm not sure who got the worst bargain, because Prometheus gave fire to humanity, and was strapped to a rock, and I think crows pecked out his liver, and then his liver just regrew.
Oh, Jesus.
So, would you rather be Sisyphus or Prometheus?
I don't know. You've posed a good one.
And of course, the wonder of this community is let's see, that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, just one word emails. Diogenes, Diogenes, Diogenes. Oh, and there's something. Look for this at your local grocers. Dave number 11 just sent me a photograph of something I have never seen before. Old Bay brand hot sauce. Ooh.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I could get real excited about that.
Speaking of photographs, you see me on Facebook from time to time.
Yes.
Did you see my photo yesterday of Professor Longhair?
No.
About me not having had a haircut since March 4th of 2020.
Going there now.
And I came back from running errands yesterday and said, well, my hair is clean. Let me brush it out here, and I'll take a picture and share it with people. And I limp.
Damn, yours is like mine.
Yeah, it's shoulder length. I was trying to figure the last time I had had it that long, and it was my senior year in high school.
Because the last one of yours I saw was when you posted, what was it, your seventh grade picture?
Oh, yeah. I was the nerd in the top row.
Yeah. I didn't realize you were a tall drink of water.
Oh, I am that. I was, they used to tell me I'd be a big help to my mama when I grew up.
You grew up.
Anyway, I just is everything okay? Because I was going to call yesterday, but then you weren't. You were had family stuff.
Yeah, just stuff. Yeah, it's okay.
Okay.
And Flavio reminds us, yes, Diogenes with a lamp was a guy going. He was the guy that went around with a lamp looking for an honest man in Greece.
Now, who is Euripides?
Euripides was a playwright.
Oh.
He was also a fashion designer, and he would say, "Euripides, I break at your face."
Was he a member of the Athens Pants Pressers Union, who did a work stoppage once, and the wording on the sign was "Strike while the iron is hot." But the pump.
Okay, you're going to hell for that one. He was one of the great playwrights. He wrote the Trojan Women. One of the greatest anti-war plays of all time.
The Trojan Women, did you say?
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
And a lot of his stuff was... Well, we are fortunate to have the few scripts that we do have, because most of them were lost.
Didn't anybody in ancient Greece do stand-up? Was all of the heavy stuff where you pluck your eyes out?
Oh, hell no!
The
Greek comedy was, and it still is, just... deliriously, filthily funny. Lysistrata, where the Greek women decide that they're really sick of all this goddamn war, so they decide that they're gonna withhold sex from their men until they come to their senses and make peace. It's hilarious, because the ancient Greeks weren't nearly as fussy as puritanical, Calvinistic we are, because characters would walk around on stage in Greek comedy with, 3-foot schlongs that had to be held up with a stick poking out from, and the Romans picked that up right away. Oh, I got a cowbell for Euripides, I break at your face. Thank you, Jeremy. Sophocles, Euripides, those were real people. Those were playwrights. And Oedipus is at least a legendary or mythological feature, like Theseus, because Prometheus and Sisyphus were godlike people who were punished because, among other things, Prometheus actually loved humanity and wanted to help. And that's why I gave him fire.
I'm trying to remember whether in my educational career, whether I had to read Oedipus. I'm sure it was a sign, and I'm also sure I never read it. I kind of made do with listening to the Tom Lehrer song, one of his shortest songs, Oedipus Rex. There once was a man named Oedipus Rex. You may have heard about his odd complex. His name appears in Freud's index because he loved his mother. And folks who want to hear the rest will
look it up
themselves.
Yes,
look it up themselves. But I don't know. I'm a positive person, Robin.
I know this about me. It's difficult right now.
Sometimes it just. And maybe it's starting to wear on me, the fact that we're this far into this thing and we've got, we're just hovering over the possibility of maybe, possibly, in a best case scenario, getting somewhat close to herd immunity so that we can all go out again.
Where are we right now? 20%? No, we're not close to, no.
No, but what I'm saying is if everybody who needs to gets their one or two vaccinations, depending on which brand they use, the people who don't want to wear masks, at some point, if we all play our cards right and behave like responsible human beings, we can get back to something that passes for normal. And you would think that everybody would be on board with that. But no. I feel a rant coming on.
I know we spend probably way too much time talking about the odious shit that fucker Carlson says, but he's getting dangerous. I mean, he's killing his own audience at this point in time because he suggested that 30 people die daily from the COVID-19 vaccine. And that's dangerous because it means more than 30 people will die from not getting the COVID vaccine.
Wait a minute. Is he selling it along the lines of, well, only 30 people will die every day?
No, he's selling it along the lines of, Jesus, we don't really know anything about this goddamn vaccine. It's killing 30 people a day.
Oh, that's that. As far as I know, and I know enough, no one has really died from the vaccine itself.
Well, there are those blood clot cases. But the numerically, statistically, the risk is way, 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 way low.
Hold on.
I mean, and it happens. It happens primarily among women. There has been a case of a man who had, and they're researching why. And so. For instance, among women, okay, we talked about this one evening. Women have a slightly higher risk of blood clots than do men. What in God's name are you doing?
I was rinsing off the spoon. We go through this every time. We could be married, you know?
No, we couldn't, and let's don't say we didn't.
Okay, all right.
But, because your hair is prettier than mine. A woman's risk for blood clots is greater from taking the pill, birth control pills, than it is from this vaccine.
Yeah.
I mean, it's at a level that is, and I don't want to come across the wrong way, but it's at a level that is not even statistically noticeable. But it's being jumped on by people like Tucker Carlson. Oh, you don't want the vaccine. And so in Tucker Carlson's world, what he was implying on Wednesday night's program was that if you die after you get the vaccine, you died from the vaccine. You know, you get the vaccine and you run out in the street yelling, yay, I got the vaccine, and you get hit by a bus. Okay? Or you get the vaccine and you're a teacher, and the next day you go to school, and some freedom protector lets loose with an AR-15, Tucker Carlson will tell you that you died of the vaccine.
There really ought to be laws or regulations, and I know it's cable TV, and that thing is just not, the standards are not as stringent. And categorizing it as one's opinion and free speech will only take you so far.
Somewhere between 2 and 5 people out of every million who get the shot have an allergic reaction. So consequently, you stay for 30 minutes after the shot and you're good to go. I don't even know how to calculate what that percentage is. And human beings are going to have we are diverse enough genetically that somebody's going to have an allergic reaction.
And the thing is, it's not the virus; it's the RHN. Is that what
I RNA.
Always get my RNA? It's not the RNA. Factor part of the vaccine that most people react to badly in terms of an early demise. It's the medium in which the goodies are the serum itself, the carrying mechanism that the viable part is in. And I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure that that's what sometimes will cause a bad reaction. And speaking of that, I know a lot of the Horn family have been strongly inviting me to go out and get my one or two shots, depending. And I've got a doctor's appointment Monday.
And if the doctor doesn't offer it in the office, which I know some doctors do and some don't, right after the doctor's appointment, I'm going to get the shot.
Do please, because you got to get out.
I know. I don't know. I've as much as I get cabin fever from time to time, there's something rather nice about only going out a couple of times a month and not being bothered with the, you know, with the hubbub in the world today.
What's all the hubbub,
what's all the hubbub, bub? I wasn't all that, you know, active and outgoing before this thing started, so this hasn't been much of a stretch for me. Oh, and I hope Steve in Georgia Stan is listening.
He is.
I have a TV viewing tip that I came across quite by accident. It's on Amazon Prime Video. It's BuzzFeed Unsolved. And there are like dozens of short episodes. And basically it's these two guys, and every episode they take an event, usually a crime or a mystery, and they talk about it. And they do a good job of straight ahead reporting of whatever the event was, but they are just as snarky as fuck. The comments that they make as they're discussing whatever the thing is are literally, for me at least, laugh out loud funny. The title is BuzzFeed Unsolved, and it's on Amazon Prime Video. Ask for it by name. It's some very funny stuff. And who couldn't use a laugh in today's world, Robin? I mean, come on.
Absolutely. And by the way, going back to Euripides, Mighty Mouse reminds us, Euripides wrote, "Men go mad when they think too much," and then says, "I put that in my college notebook and skipped class after that." That's kind of like, I think in my years as a Latin student, I ran across a quote from Horace.
Height and his band of delight.
Shut up.
I'm sorry.
But it was, "As a true translator, you will take care not to translate word for word." And I wrote that at the top of every test paper. Because I was, you know, looking for a loophole.
Yes.
Well, no, it doesn't say that exactly, and my grasp on the subjunctive is tenuous, but as a true translator, you'll take care not to translate word for word. So that.
I honor anyone who can master a foreign language, or even our native language.
Well, Flavio is the past master of the art of word knowing. I think Flavio has five languages.
Jesus.
English, Portuguese, Italian, French, and something. Yeah.
I just admire anybody who is that disciplined and can get their head around. You know, I took 1 year of high school French. I was mystified by it. I know chapeau, I know cravat, I know Monsieur and Madame Thibault, the characters in the textbook.
Yes, of course.
But crayon.
I always loved la robe. I always found foreign languages fascinating and enjoyable, and I kind of got them pretty easily.
I think it's like math. I think you have to be wired.
You have a facility for it. Yeah.
And I did. La tête.
I mean, I discovered the other day, it was quite surprising, that little Lucy Per Morning Paw, our little tortie, is either a French speaker or the reincarnation of Gomez Adams. Because she was being kind of standoffish, and Agnes was calling to her to come over here, and she was just looking at her mother like a cow looks at a new gate. And I called to her in French, and she walked right over and purred at me. I'm like, well, I'll be damned.
And was she wearing a little kitty beret?
She was wearing it, and it was très adorable.
And a striped jersey?
Exactly. Exactement.
Was her cigarette in a holder?
It was a guitar.
Je te plumerai la tête.
Hey, Scott, I got a bunch of people calling in.
Well, and they probably should after all this.
And you know? We've certainly created lots of conversational space in which to exist.
Wait, Robin, we've done what we have always done. We have covered the waterfront. Another great tune, Billie Holiday. Look it up. Give it a listen. Anyway, thank you for this time together.
I'm so glad we had this time together. No singing!
No singing, damn it. Anyway, thank you for being upright and above ground. And I'm, boys and girls, I'm really not as negative as I sounded today. I just... Every now and again, I just have to let off steam, and I thank you for your indulgence. That's all.
You are more than welcome, and you know you are a little you are generally optimistic, but you're also the person who gave us. We're all screwed.
We're all screwed, Robin. Anyway, take care, and I anticipate great conversation in the final hour of today's broadcast.
We will certainly hope. And by the way, Jack in Shreveport said, "I got your reference earlier." He said, "Is that Cock in a Box? I think that's from an SNL sketch."
Yeah. Yes, it is.
Yeah. It's right, my...
Take care. Take care. Bye,
Mr.
Lincoln. Shane, come back.
I was going right to Shane. I'll see you, Scott. Come back,
bye,
Shane.
Robin, take care.
Later.
Bye.
Bye. And... let's see here. Let me run over to the stress line. By the way, if we could knock out 120 more bucks this evening, so that we're not looking at $1,000 Friday on the front porch community made miracle, that would be fantastic. And take a lot of weight off of, because I live in a constant state of stress and worry. Trying to keep this thing all, you know, going. And so that's the thing. Well, thank you very kindly, Jude. Jude in the Great Northwest. Just saw one of my photos, recent photos. She said, "My heart be still, sister dear. First photo I've viewed of the lady you are. In this complicated world, I've traveled the path of my own making, seeking to experience those who also discover their personal path, courage, humility, grace of being, openness to the majestic surprises." What a wonderful phrase that is, the majestic surprises. "You, dear heart, are a delightful surprise in the evolution of your uniqueness, sending the finest of intentions as I know you do for me. In peace, Jude." Jude, that is just, that is the sweetest thing. And I appreciate you saying that. It's most, most lovely. And I do. I can't say thank you. Well enough. Thank you, Jude. And over to the stress line real quick. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Yes.
Hello?
Hello?
I have a question for you.
No, Jim. Okay, let's check in with Tracy. Hey, Tracy.
Okay, what was that all about?
I don't know.
Yeah. No, who? So, hi, how's everybody doing and all that good stuff?
I'm doing dandy. Dandy-ish. Well, yeah, and how did it go?
I am just very grateful for Zoom because my knees were shaking and it was terrible.
But they couldn't hear your knees knocking.
No, they couldn't hear my knees knocking, and that's the beautiful thing. That is the beautiful thing because it was like I was terrified. I did not know. I mean, I've spoken in front of people before, you know, I've called on the show. I think because it was my research, you know, and I was presenting this to people, you know, to the chair of my department, other PhDs within, you know, the Africana Studies Department and whatnot and so forth. And so it was terrifying. But I did. I mean, I got compliments. The department chair said thank you for your research. It was amazing. One of the professors said that what I presented, she already knew anecdotally, but now she's going to use my research in conversation.
Wow.
I'm like,
yeah, and make sure you get credit.
Yeah, most definitely. You know, but we had a Q&A and I had to like think on, you know, I'm like, shit, I got to answer questions. I can't just go talk and just be about my business. Oh no, Miss Porter, you have to ask the questions too. And I'm like, fuck.
You have to, and you have to defend yourself. You have to defend your ideas.
I had to defend my ideas, but like the best, I think because after I couldn't see the chat because I had my PowerPoint open, but at the end of my presentation, I could see in, you know, what people wrote in the chat, and because I have to present the methodology. And so just real quick, so using the methodology of Afrocentricity, this research seeks to explore African-American Black attitudes regarding same-race counselor preferences and if the increase of African-American Black counselors would increase African-American Black's use of counseling services. Afrocentricity is a theoretical framework to be used to examine and advance African-American people in every sector of society. Afrocentricity means placing African culture, experience, and ideals at the center of any analysis of African phenomena. Research demonstrates the need to develop an accurate assessment of African-American Black counseling preference. Applying the Afrocentric methodology, this research will examine African-American Black attitudes and preference regarding counselors. And then I said, and for all y'all like me who didn't know what that meant until I went back to school, in other words, instead of using the racially biased Eurocentric method of studying Black people through the lens of white supremacy, which views Black people as inferior, I instead use the Afrocentric method, which puts who Black people really are and our inherent excellence and humanity as the center of my research. That part. And so I got all these like,
damn, that's fine. That is fine.
So yeah, that was yeah.
And it's a great point too.
Yes, I mean that's the and you know the one of the main problems with you know research, you know, we like in Black studies we call it, you know, the study of Black people or Black studies, and when you and the different to differentiate the study of Black people is basically, you know. You know, coming from the, you know, deficit that, you know, the only thing, you know, that our history didn't begin until 1619.
Yeah.
That, you know.
And there's a lot of fragile white folks don't want anybody teaching that.
Right. And that, you know, that because of who we are, that we are less than, and that, you know, we will never amount to anything. And again, it's teaching us at a deficit, you know, Black people at a deficit. And so that is the beautiful thing about, you know, the Afrocentric framework, because it's like it answers so many questions. It's like, you know, when, you know, our kids are, you know, suspended and expelled from school at a higher rate than white kids because, you know, because of the way we walk, the way we talk, the way we dress, the way we present ourselves. And, you know, and it's always viewed, especially from white people, as threatening or unprofessional or, you know, chaotic. Or use any, you know, word that you want to make us feel less than. So when you're teaching and talking to children on this framework, you're letting them know that who you are is amazing. How you learn, you know, is different than how white people learn. And this is why we have to teach Black children how, you know, a certain way of learning. You know, and it's just, you know, I've even, you know, when I started doing this research, I realized how I always felt that there was always that part of me that felt that I was less than and that I wasn't quite smart enough and I didn't understand stuff. And it's because I didn't give a fuck. Bottom line is, I didn't give a flying fuck about old white people, dead white people. It didn't speak to me. It didn't had nothing to do with my lived experience. And that is why most and a lot of black kids do so poorly in school. Because the curriculum has nothing to do with who we are as black people. You know? So, yeah, there's a whole lot more research I have to do, you know, but it's not going to stop with what I, you know. But I was just like, wow. Wow, wow, wow.
I'm as proud as I can be of you. You got a note from Jack in Shreveport who said, would you, here, let me find it. Jack said, I missed what Tracy first said. I was distracted. Was this a defense of an independent research project, like a 3 to 5 credit, one semester class load kind of thing? Or what exactly? Yeah.
So this is what this class is, Africana Studies 498. It's the pro seminar in Africana Studies. So it's basic. I'm supposed to take it as a senior, and I'm supposed to, I am a senior, but it's usually the last class you take in Africana Studies. And it is basically everything that you have learned as an Africana Studies major. And so you decide at the beginning of the semester what you want to talk about, what subject as far as Africana studies within the discipline do you want to address as far as black people are concerned. And the webinar was recorded, so I will send as soon as it's available, I will send the link. But we had talking about food deserts, the effects of, not having organic foods in black communities or just fresh food, period. We talked about images of the portrayals of black women in media. We talked about colorism in the media. We talked about what happens about the gentrification. We talked about the effects of mass incarceration on, mental health of black people. We talked about, I've never done anything like this, but I've attended, a couple of webinars given by, people with doctorates and, scholars in the discipline. But I had never, to hear my fellow students, talk with such authority. And, and you can hear, we were all nervous, okay? And, I had to take us, put in.
There would be something fundamentally wrong with you if you weren't. I don't care how, right. I don't care what level of mastery you have over your subject matter. That's a nerve-wracking experience.
It's a nerve-wracking experience. But to hear, they refer to me in my class as Miss Tracy because I'm definitely old. I'm old enough to be everybody in that class and probably even my professor's mother.
Well, you haven't been promoted. You haven't been promoted to auntie?
Well, I get it between. It either goes between Miss Tracy or Auntie Tracy. And so, but to hear these young black people with this knowledge and this passion for the
inspiring as hell, ain't it?
It is fucking inspiring as hell. I was just. It moved me to tears. I was trying to contain myself because it was three different sessions, and the last session I was the fucking moderator, and I'm like, oh my god, I had to be a moderator on top of everything else. But again, it was just to hear. This whole thing was, the pure and true definition of black excellence, and And, you know, I was just, I was floored by these young people because the average age of the people in my class are like 20. These are 20-year-olds.
Yeah.
You know, these are babies. And you know, in the grand scheme of things, when you're looking at, you know, how old you and I are, you know, and I just can't imagine when I was 20 years old being that so self-assured and knowledgeable and just, you know, and had my shit down. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And they have, you know? those young students, you know, they didn't just... They had the core of what they needed, but that confidence had to be instilled and nurtured.
Exactly.
So there's been a lot of somebodies out there doing a hell of a lot of good work. And by the way, let's see. Jeremy says, hearing the evolution of Tracy over the years has been inspiring, to say the least. Congrats on all the hard work and all your success. That's from Jeremy in Vermont. Ralph says you go, girl. And as to the use of the term Afrocentric, Ron in Raleigh says, tell Tracy not to forget about the white devils and Dr. Yacoub.
Exactly.
You know, but this is a conversation that's been taking place for a very long time, going back to, and even before Frederick Douglass, and up through the contentious debate between Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois.
And man, that was contentious.
Oh yeah, yeah. Those two gentlemen did not like each other, I don't think.
I mean, if they had a chance to cut each other, they would have.
Yeah, but with the lens of history, you can look back and see where they both were right.
Yes.
I was, and we've talked about this in the past, the Southern Exposition speech from Booker T. Washington in Atlanta, where he said, you know, you can either incorporate us into the life of the nation, or we will forever be a millstone hanging around your neck.
Around your neck.
It's hard to argue with. But then, you know, he was more accommodating to white supremacy.
He was very accommodating to white supremacy. His whole idea, and this is why Republicans love him so very much.
Right up there with the only quote they ever know that Dr. King ever uttered.
Yeah, it is just their whole, because his whole philosophy was, you know, work hard, you know, learn a vocation, you know, don't go any higher than, you know, like, you know, don't go to college. No. Work hard, you know, learn a vocation, learn a craft, make your money, and show the white folks that we are worthy of, you know, and we then eventually they will see how wonderful we are, and they will eventually give us our civil rights.
Yeah, you were probably thinking about other things on Tuesday night, but I had that clip of that jackass from Knoxville, Tennessee, arguing that the Three-Fifths Compromise was intended to be a way of ending slavery. And that's, you know, and that's, yeah, I know, but that's what we're up against. And that is what black, you know.
I know what you meant. I know what you meant, baby. I knew.
Little black chick Robin. I'm going to, me and Rachel Dolezal. Yes.
You and my girl, Rachel. Yes.
Yeah. Sorry. But that's what has to be deconstructed, and that is why there is such an uproar over critical race theory.
Yes, and like right now, okay. So in the state of California, AB SB. Okay, I can never remember the numbers, but a bill passed in the state of California that in every UC, not UC, I'm sorry, Cal State, starting, I think, with people entering this fall of 2021, that you must take a ethnic studies class, I think at least two, maybe, that in order to graduate. Period. If you don't take it, you don't graduate. You know.
And see that that is why California is going to become the seedbed for a growing black intellectualism, I think, because there is such a white lash against all things academic relative to the black experience in America. And so, you know, scholars will have to spread out from California across the country. I mean, that's not to say there aren't other Africana programs or black history programs, but they are few and far between, and they're not happening to some great degree in states that are so far benighted past.
In that part. Right. And so it's like when, you know, and even within Africana studies, there's a lot of work to be done. I mean, y'all know my journey and trying to find who I am and, you know, finding, you know, a place, a community aside from, you know, the Horn, you know, but an actual physical community that I'm a part of because I've never really fit in anywhere. And so when I, you know, like my teacher says, to become an Africana studies major, it is a political choice. I am making a political statement saying that, you know, I'm tired of our experiences, our history, our culture, and everything it is about being black. Has, you know, like I said, that our, you know, that our history starts in 1619, that we are deficient, that we are, you know, less than, and all these other things. And to make the choice to become an Africana studies major is to go on a journey of, as one of the panelists said, of myth busting, of getting rid of all these lies that you have heard about yourselves and your people for centuries. And but, you know, like I said, I was so excited, you know, having black teachers and, you know, surrounded by black people, even in the Zoom environment, because as you guys know, you know, I started school last year and I have yet to, you know, actually be in a physical classroom. So, but still to see the, you know, the black faces and have black instructors and all this. But as I'm doing my studies and reading, you know, the you know, literature and who are the people who are considered the elders of black studies, because as far as an official, you know, discipline of black studies, I didn't start until, you know, officially until 1968 at San Francisco State University, when black students with Asian students and sympathetic whites and white allies and all these other people closed the school down and demanded black studies, you know, because it was like, you know, we're talking, you know, moving from the civil rights movement into the black power movement. But anyway, as I was, you know, I'm reading, you know, these elders, like I said, the you know, the people who, you know, came up with the curriculum and all this, I was disturbed and heartbroken of all the homophobia and the misogyny within black studies. And so as a queer black woman, how do you think that made me feel? I'm like, holy shit. I said, I can't catch a fucking break anywhere. Here I is supposed to be amongst my folks, and even still I'm marginalized. It is, you know, and so there is, but the beautiful thing, and one of the tenets, if we truly follow the tenets of what black studies is supposed to be, it is always evolving. It is always expanding. It is supposed and is always
because the experience is ever changing.
Exactly. And that's the beautiful thing about what Black Studies is supposed to be, because it's a very if you really look at it, it's a very young discipline. It is, you know, it's a baby. In comparison to, you know, English and philosophy and, you know, all the white things. So, you know, so again, I'm not making excuses for these people, but you have to look at the framework of who and where these people were coming from. But yet and still, if you're if you're truly a student of Black Studies, and if you truly go back to Kemet and stuff like that, you will see how in ancient Kemet, there was really no gender. We had two spirit people, people who what we consider, gay or whatever right now, were in vaulted positions. They were the elders and they were the shamans, and they had a certain knowledge that everybody didn't have. It wasn't until we got here and we started listening and started, like I said, viewing everything in that Eurocentric framework.
And that white Christian lens.
That right Christian lens, that binary is either black or white. There's nothing in between. Everything is this or that. That is when we lost our way. And it's not our fault. We were, socialized into thinking this is what we are and who we are. I mean, so there's a lot of work to be done. But again, it is just, I can't wait until I get the recording so you can hear it.
Oh, I'm eager to see it.
Like I was getting comments, like one of the things that I was talking about one of the problems, of course, for Black people trying to get a Black therapist or counselor, is just that we're overrepresented in the population that needs mental health care, but underrepresented in professionals.
Your caregivers.
Your caregivers. And so, like in a 2015 study, 86% of professional psychologists identified as white. Only 4% identified as Black. So then you have Black people who make up basically like 13.4% of the population of the United States. But yet, of those numbers, 16% report having mental health issues. And remember, those are only the ones that have actually reported.
Right. Because the number is probably significantly higher.
Significantly higher. So when you say 16%, Tracy, how many people is 16%? That is 7 million Black folks that need mental health care.
Mm-hmm.
7 million out of,
And God only knows, and God alone knows what that number will be as we have progressed through the pandemic.
Exactly. And that's another part of my research that I didn't cross into because I didn't talk about, because one of the problems, especially when COVID first hit and we were told to wear masks, Black people were like, wait a minute, you want me as a Black person to walk into a public place with a mask on? Are you kidding me?
Because you know what's going to happen. And there is, there is a little addressed crisis of mental health generally in this country today. It did not begin with the pandemic, Tracy, but it has certainly been made exponentially worse by the pandemic. And so the harder a community is hit by COVID, the greater the need for care, behavioral health care, And it's simply not there.
It's not there.
And
it is not.
And this is a function. Well, here we go. This is a function of letting capitalism run the healthcare system.
It is
brutally difficult to become a degreed therapist, counselor in the first place. And you make it even more so because of how brutally difficult it is for people of color to get the necessary education. And we're making it worse because it is harder to go to college now than it ever has been before, or at least in modern history. And by the way, more notes of love and respect coming in. Scott in San Diego says, you go, Tracy. Never think of yourself as less than. You're more than in my book. You're bringing nothing but good stuff to the party and the conversation, resonance and relevance. You got that thing going on. So that's Scott. And then Jude, dear Jude, said, hearing Tracy's tonal ease, joyful in a celebration of accomplishment, lifts all of us. Coming home is beautiful to the Horn family, and our arms are open wide, dear Tracy. Job well done. Now the next door is about to be revealed. Be well, love, Jude.
Jude is so amazing. I just, man, the love I get from my folks. I mean, y'all just, you just don't know. I mean, again, I even at my lowest, and, you know, y'all know I've been mighty low. But, you know, then I think I've actually, I wrote something about this in a paper, and I was talking about, you know, those little voices that we have that, you know, they're very quiet, they're very faint, and they're in the distance, and they talk about how great you are and how amazing you are. But because of everything that is going on around us and in our hearts and our minds and all these things, we don't hear that voice.
Or we will stifle it, or we will not believe it.
Or we will stifle it, or we will not believe it. But, you know, whenever I feel this way and I think about it, I hear, you know, my Horn family, you know, helping me push back all that bullshit and clear away all the muck and the mire and the quicksand and all of this. And, you know, I hear you guys, you know, chanting Tracy, Tracy. And, you know, I feel it. It is palpable. It is just to know that you have, that somebody has your back.
Yeah. That, and that's, you know, that's why this is so much more than just an internet thing, you know, because we do meet each other in real life, and we find ourselves every bit as much a part of a real community as an online one, because it carries over into the real world.
It takes
Darlene in Connecticut just sent a note. Wow, my white privilege was just revealed to me thanks to Tracy. It never occurred to me about the lack of black psychotherapists. Shit, I feel like such a jerk right now. I love Tracy. Please thank her for educating me.
Yeah, I mean, and Darlene, it's not your fault. I mean, it is just that, like I said, because of the dominant culture in this country and how white supremacy and this bullshit of American exceptionalism and all this other shit has been forced down our throats since the first time we walked into a classroom, we have no idea just how much other people are hurting. Because since we don't matter, the studies that were done, again, about black people and mental health issues was looked at through a European lens. So, you know, we don't, you know, so until, you know, you start thinking about it on what it is truly to be black in this country. And so, you know, thank goodness we're, you know, kind of at the point in this country where we're having these talks. about, you know, cultural competency.
Right, because these maggots and delicate, aggrieved white conservatives, they are in a changing world that they cannot stop.
They cannot.
And
stop.
that's what all the bawling and caterwauling is about. I did not know you were going to call this evening, and so in the course of, I ran across this one, and this is just such an example. The woman in the story, her name is Carlette Duffy, and she was trying to get her house near Indianapolis, on the outskirts of Indianapolis, in a primarily black neighborhood. She was trying to get her house appraised, and lo and damn behold, it was getting appraised for less money than she paid for it in 2017.
Mm-hmm.
And yep. So she went through. She happened to read an article in the New York Times about discrimination in real estate appraisal. What the fuck? Yeah, really, because it's everywhere. And so she went through. She said, "I took down every photo of my family from my home. I took every piece of ethnic artwork out. So any African artwork, I took it out. I displayed my degrees. I removed certain books." And then she got a white guy friend of hers to sit in on the appraisal. And then when she filed the application, she didn't say anything about being black. And lo and behold, the appraisal came back at more than twice as much as the two previous ones.
That part.
So as long as her house did not have the mark of blackness,
that black stain,
the curse of Ham.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus Christ, I can't believe it. And so she's filed a discrimination complaint, and with any luck at all, she will win. And then of course there will be rivers of tears on fucking Fox, you know.
Oh God, yes.
Okay. And Darlene wants to know: have you given any thought to taking your degree far enough for you to teach? Darlene says she'd be fantastic teaching people of all ethnicities. Maybe through local libraries too, and 'cause see that's the thing. The black experience is a subset of the human experience.
Exactly.
And it's not that and you are absolutely right that there is a desperate need for the black community to have access to its own history. Unvarnished, unedited, unwhitewashed. But I think, and tell me if I'm wrong, I think it would be good to say, as the Cal State system is saying, everybody needs to learn it. Everybody exactly. benefits from it. I mean, I'm not Greek by any stretch of the imagination. I benefit from knowing what the ancient Greeks were thinking. I'm not Asian. I'm not Japanese. But oh my God, what is to be taken from that history?
That part.
And we need to treat the history, and not just history, but the history coming out of the African experience with every bit as much respect and gravity, and maybe even go so far, Tracy, tell me if I'm wrong, even when we say something like Afrocentric, we're being, in a way, overly broad, because it's a huge fucking continent with a shit ton of cultures.
Yeah, I mean, and definitely within we have a review report called the National Council of Black on Black Studies, and even at the beginning, like I said, you know, back in '68, when you know we were finally fighting to get, you know, actual. I mean, there was all now, you know, there was always, you know, like, you know, black studies classes, black this and this and this, but it wasn't a discipline. You couldn't get a degree in black studies or Africana studies or whatever.
And it tracks in parallel with the struggle for women's studies.
And queer studies, which
are all routinely dismissed as frivolous by white patriarchal culture.
And it's also, you know, deemed frivolous within Africana studies as well. It's like, well, why do we need women's studies? Well, bitch, because what black women built this fucking movement and built this goddamn country.
Ron and Raleigh was pointing out that critical race theory was announced and developed by black women scholars in 1970 freaking two.
That part.
But white America that just part. Found out it exists and they're scared.
Right. It's like, oh my God, really? So, you know, one of the big one of the biggest issues as far as, you know, if you're going to put the under the umbrella of ethnic studies, and then you have Asian American studies, Latinx studies, Native American studies, and then you have queer studies, gender and women's studies, and whatnot and so forth. So one of the main tenets, there's like two, you know, main tenets in black studies that we have yet, as you know, as me as a student scholar, and but like at the elders, one of the main two of the things were to involve the community within, you know, so it's not just within the colleges. We were supposed, as black studies majors and scholars and whatnot and so forth, we weren't supposed to just, you know, not for lack of a better phrasing, stay in the ivory tower. We were supposed to go out within the community and teach, you know, within our community about this, our history, who we are as black people. I mean, and you have it in small parts, you know, like in Oakland and stuff like that. But broadly, no. And also, that this, as black studies, should be a mandate that it is part of the K-12 curriculum. And then, you have states like Arizona who have effectively outlawed ethnic studies. It can't be taught.
Right, yeah.
You know, it'll cause an uprising. No, it will cause it will cause a bit of an uprising because people will wake up and realize that the lies and the bullshit that they have been learning to be like, oh my fucking God, y'all been lying to me all these years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but people a sense of confidence.
But you know what? I was taught as a little redneck child in Alabama, I was taught that George Washington Carver came up with more than 100 uses for the peanut.
See, I mean, because you know the.
I'm not taking anything away there, but I mean,
no, but I know what you're saying, because see,
but that was as crazy as it may sound, that may actually have been a slightly more enlightened Alabama. You probably can't do that now.
Right. And it's like, you know, what black studies are allowed, you know, when black studies are allowed within the K-12 curriculum, depending on, you know, where you are in the country, it's very limited. I mean, you know, one of the things I wrote a paper, I said the breadth, the extent of my, you know, K-12 exposure to black culture and black history was, we were slaves, Lincoln freed us, and then it was Martin Luther King. And, you know, we were only exposed to what white people deemed as, you know, safe stuff to learn about, you know.
Right.
So, of course, yeah,
the
I'm
good
not
ones.
Learn about
the good
X.
ones.
You know, I'm not going to learn about James Baldwin. I'm not going to learn about the Black Panther Party for self-defense, Yeah. I'm not going to learn about Fannie Lou Hamer. I'm not going to learn about Ida B. Wells. I'm not going to learn about Toussaint Louverture. You know, I'm not going to learn about, you know, David Walker. I'm not going to learn about all, you know, and et cetera, and so forth. You know, I'm not going to, you know, all these magnificent black people who have shaped this country, who have contributed to this country. But as long as, you know, white supremacy is what is, you know, what's happening in this country, you will never know anything about anybody except for white people. As far as your K through 12 curriculum is concerned. And when I first went back to school, and I had a surface level of understanding about, you know, who we are as a people and, you know, and stuff like that. And when I went back to school the first time and took my very first black studies class, I could not believe just how evil and horrible and just despicable certain white people were. Mm-hmm. And what they, you know, and how, you know, when I learned about lynching, when I learned about Tulsa and Rosewood and, you know, all these riots and, you know, I think what upset me the most, especially when I was learning about how white people just came and just wantonly, you know, tore up, you know, destroyed and burned down, and in some cases, fucking bombed black communities. Y'all didn't want us in your community, all right? Y'all don't want us. So we decide, okay, we don't want to be a part of you. You don't want us to be a part of you. We don't want to be a part of y'all. So we're going to make our own community, self-sufficient, you know, have our own.
Yeah, do that Booker T. Washington thing.
You know, we're doing that Booker T. Washington thing. You know, we're staying out of y'all's way. We're not asking you for shit. But because y'all saw us doing well, how dare you? How dare you, you uppity Negroes decide that you are better than, you know, and it's never, ever been that we felt that we were better than white people. No, we just wanted to be treated fairly. That, you know, and yeah. Like I signed up for a tutor and, you know, these tutoring services and, you know, they ask you what you need help with and stuff like that. And I was getting all these responses from, you know, white tutors because, of course, there's going to be more white tutors than black tutors. So I added to my profile, I am a 55-year-old queer black woman. My major is Africana Studies. In my studies and the papers that I will be writing, I will be exploring and deciphering and, you know, about, you know, the dismantling of white supremacy, black liberation, and, you know, so forth and so on. And so just to let you know, Africana Studies, while it is pro-black, it is not anti-white. Because I just want...
No, hell no. It's not a zero-sum game. It's not...
It's not... I mean...
There's not a mercantilist quantum of respect, and one is taken away... And you know, the addition of one takes away from another. That's, you know, that's again, that's a bullshit capitalist idea of limited of resource limitation.
Exactly. So, because the bottom line is, and you know, as we all know within the Horn family, but especially to these fragile white people. You know, as much as they act like we're in, you know, a post-racial world and everybody is coon fucking by ya and blah, blah, fucking blah. The bottom line is white people you know, because, you know, there's always their campus trying to say that, they never realize just how bad it is. Oh, is it really that bad? And blah, blah, blah. But deep down, they know how bad it is. And there's this fear that if black people, brown people, or just BIPOC people,
that one of these days they're gonna treat us as bad as we treated them.
Absolutely. And that is not in our name.
And that is that's the core of white fear from 1619, and frankly white fear from before that, when you take into account the Spanish and the Portuguese.
That part.
And I did want to let you know, because we're kind of running short. One,
yeah.
you continue to get praise and accolades. Secondly, I just want to remind you never to underestimate your own power to inspire others. And I mention this as a form of accountability. I'm trying to hold myself accountable. I'm trying to make a lot of changes in my life.
Right.
And I had an interview today at the local fitness facility.
Okay.
And we took all my necessary measurements, and we set goals, and I explained what I wanted to have happen, and they said, this is absolutely accomplishable. You're not setting any kind of goal that's unreasonable. I want to get my A1C down. I want to drop my lipids. I want to further build on my quit smoking. I want to get in the best physical shape I can possibly be, because I'm anticipating somewhere down the road some significant surgical insults.
Right.
And I want to be strong and competent and capable for that. And as I sat there going through all that information, I thought of you.
Me?
I thought of you. And all the strength and determination and courage that you have shown, that you have dug deep within yourself to find. And I knew that. I mean, I'm trying to say I know I can do it, not I hope I can do it. I must do this.
Yeah.
And I want this. And I know through your example that I can make that a reality. Because in terms of goals, we talked about getting in 4 months' time, 5 months, let's see, in 4 months' time, dropping below 25% body fat.
Nice.
on the way toward 20. Giving me a little bit more of a tummy I can be proud of. And for the first, and doing something strength training wise or toning wise, where I will finally have a butt.
you won't be no longer suffering from no acetal disease.
Exactly. I'm looking forward. It's going to be ugly and sweaty and uncomfortable and probably painful.
Very, yes.
But what worth having in life isn't.
No, and it's like, you know, I have not exercised in a long time. I just got sucked in with school, and that's something I had to really work on, you know, that self-care, and taking that time just for me, taking the time to go outside and get fresh air and walking and, you know, easing back into a routine. But when we, you know, it's as hard as I'm working with school and my pursuits and all that, I have to remember that I have to take care of myself.
Self-care is a thing.
Self-care ain't no joke. It's truly a thing.
I mean, I used to hear about it during lectures in seminars and so forth related to the struggle against mountaintop removal.
Right.
And when I first heard it, it sounded sort of touchy-feely...
Really new age hippie.
Yeah, you know, I got to stare at a crystal or something.
What is this deep breathing shit? What the? Come on.
And then you get far enough into it and you realize, if I don't do this, it will consume me. And I will be no good to nobody.
You will burn out. You will stop wanting to do what you're doing. And, you know, but, it, you know, oh, in answer to Darlene's question about being a teacher, I've toyed with the idea, and all of my professors and my classmates are like, you are going to be a teacher, right? And I'm like, I don't know if I have the patience for teaching, because when I'm listening to somebody's cheering, or better yet, fetuses in my classes, I don't know if I have that patience. Now, what I have thought about is like being a lecturer, consultant, you know, speaker, what have you, on certain subjects. And besides the fact, I don't want to grade anybody's fucking papers.
Yeah, that's a damn grind.
That is such a grind. And, you know, I have a finite amount of time left on this earth. I'd be damned if I want to spend it grading papers. But I do, Darlene, I do love teaching in the way, because I love imparting my wisdom. I don't know if the word is wisdom, but my
knowledge. The word's wisdom.
And, okay. I love talking just in general and just telling people about what I'm learning and, you know, and about subjects that people don't even understand, or not so much understand, but just had no clue. Like, poor Darlene's like, she's talking to me like a dad. Don't do the white guilt, baby. It's not your fault. And like you said, I mean, because, again, how are you supposed to know? Even my auntie who watched the presentation, she texted me, and she works with the Department of Children and Family Services. And so, you know, all of those kids have to go to some shape, form, or fashion of counseling. And she's like, it never, and this is a black woman. And my auntie Nisi ain't no joke. She is truly auntie, right? So my auntie Nisi, who has worked in this capacity for over 20 years, it slapped her in the face when I said those numbers. And she's like, oh my God, all these kids that her personally, just her, have sent to speak to counselors, were they culturally competent? Did they really understand or try to understand?
It's a hell of a phrase, cultural competence.
Right. To have any empathy of what it's like to be black in this country, or just, you know, what it's like to be black in the foster care system. And the reason why you're in foster care is because of this system, is because of mass incarceration, how they took your mom and your dad away from you because of a minor drug offense or whatever the case may be. And just this cycle of what this country has done. And I'm not saying poor, 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 pitiful us, but you got to take into consideration.
Sure you do. Sure you do.
What, I mean, because one of the questions was asking me, and I forget how they phrased it, but where do you see or something? And or what do we do? And I said, well, first and foremost, we must address systemic and institutional racism. And I said, but one of the main things we have to take into consideration is that all black people are hurting. We just don't understand and know why. And I said, the problem is, you know, when there's a, you know, there's a tragic moment, you know, school shooting, you know, I hate to use that, but there are counselors on the ready to help these kids to deal with that trauma. There were no counselors at the end of enslavement.
No.
You know, there was no counselors during Jim Crow. There was no counselors during at the end of Reconstruction. There was no counselors.
All there was, what there, for all intents and purposes, what there effectively was the black church.
Right, and thank God for that. But that, you know, and that is something where you, again, you know, and I y'all know I love me some Jesus. Thank you, baby black Jesus. But, I love the Lord. He heard my cry and pitied every moan. However, I still need somebody to answer me. I need somebody that I can talk to, who can I relate to, and all.
Yeah, and you need a concreteness that religion often is not suited to convey.
That part. So yeah. I know we have to go because it is 5 o'clock
well,
a week,
and
you know, it's so funny because I had not planned on calling. I really had not. Because I was still on, I'm exhausted because you know how you have, I've never felt this before, but that adrenaline high that you get and but then all of a sudden when the adrenaline is gone, you just get kind of a crash and I'm like, fuck, I'm tired, man. Dude.
Well, I did. I think I conjured you earlier because I've referenced what you have said so many times in other contexts. It's so exhausting.
Yeah.
Just soul searing. And Jack in Shreveport said this has been a very inspiring conversation and great news. Thank you, Jack.
Thank you.
And we will leave Scott's comment about Robin's new butt for another day. Jesus Christ. Why?
Just don't. If you do a Kim Kardashian,
I don't even know. It's bad enough I have to exist on the same planet with those people. Though,
exactly.
and you know what? I will those people.
Yeah, those people, exactly. Those people.
Or as I refer to, Caitlin, that horrible woman.
That horrible, you got to say it right, that horrible woman.
Yes. Tracy, congratulations, dear. I can't wait to watch it. And,
thank you, love. And I love you guys. And, again.
As we do you.
And I'm just, when I disappear, it's not because I don't love you guys anymore. It's just that I...
No, you've been working.
I've been working my ass.
And I knew that. And that's why, That's why I wasn't worried that maybe I'd made you hate me somehow or another. So no,
that would never happen. And if you did, I'd say something. If you ever said or did anything that hurt me, or even if it didn't hurt me, but I found like, oh, really? Did you say that? I would say something to you,
so
you wouldn't be wondering was it something I said? Was it something I did?
Precisely.
So, like I said, you love me and know me well enough to know that if I disappear, you know what's going on. And you do know that if something horrible or something was just so painful or what have you that I couldn't function, but I know I could pick up the phone and call you. So you know.
Exactly.
If something's just, I can't function, I need you, then there's a whole different thing. But
well, we love you dearly, and we are all proud of you and proud for you and eager to see where you go from here.
Thank you, love. I appreciate you.
As we appreciate you. Tracy, have a great night, dear. Say hi to Jan for us.
You too, baby. I will. Bye. Right.
Bye. And that's the one and only Tracy. And what a wonderful, wonderful story. So proud of her determination and commitment. And thanks to all of you for joining in and sharing your precious finite time engaging in this conversation in whatever manner you so choose. Thank you to all of our subscribers, Patreon and PayPal. Thank you to Jessica and Joey and Giraffe, and thank you to Jeremy, and thank you to Ralphs, and thank you to Mighty Mouse, who jumped in a little bit ago. Mighty Mouse said, thanks for sharing my pithy contributions now and then. Just send a double sawbuck and hope it helps keep it lit. Plus, head on as my source for Malloy Daily. Thank you, Mighty Mouse. Thank you much indeed. Let me see here. I don't want to leave anybody else out. Thank you, Timothy. Thank you very kindly. So where does that take us to? We are down to down to 780. So we will be at 1,080 for tomorrow. It's hard and scary, I know. And I appreciate everything everybody does to keep this going. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff. Thanks to Sparky and Steve in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa, headon.live. Remember, brand-new Fresh Malloy on the way. Headon.live, 9 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, 6 p.m. Pacific. The best place to listen to the first run of Malloy is headon.live. Thank you, John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, whiterosesociety.org. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, 20-plus years at the forefront of the struggle for human rights and environmental justice in Appalachia. This would be a great time to reach out to your member of the House of Representatives and ask them to co-sponsor H.R. 2073, the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Please stay safe. Get your vaccine as soon as you can. Don't touch your face. Wash your hands. Use your hand sanitizer. Maintain your social distance among the unvaccinated and unmasked. And if somebody comes towards you saying, hey, we're on Moroni, Utah, and we're burning a giant needle, avoid that person like the plague. Because he is. Later, y'all.